The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from KUT in Austin, Texas, for the rest of the week. We're so glad to be here, and we're so glad you're listening. And we begin with a story that's all about sharing. Sharing is a good thing, right? We learn all about that as little kids.
Sharing, I like to share.
Sharing is good. This is also a story about our bodies, and we learn about that when we're little. We learn not to be ashamed about our bodies. So combine sharing, a lack of shame about our bodies, with a school full of teenagers with smartphones, and you get the crisis in Canyon City, Colorado this week. There have been dozens of suspensions over the exchange of hundreds of sexts, texts with explicit photos among students, some as young as eighth grade. Another school in Kings Park, New York, on Long Island, also suspended dozens of students this week for allegedly texting sexually explicit videos of another student. This could be a teachable moment about the internet and morality and sexuality, but in Canyon City, Colorado, it's also about the rigid laws in Colorado that deems this kind of thing, naked pictures of minors, a possible felony.
You know, if you do bring the issue to a school employee, it is our current policy and job to, you know, forward this information up the chain of command and then refer to the police for investigation.
That's George Welch, the superintendent in Canyon City, Colorado. But for parents and teachers, there's a larger conversation here, a deeper conversation about the effect and impact of technology, and a real generation gap, as none of this was conceivable for high school students even a decade ago. Manush Zamarodi, host of Note to Self, a podcast from WNYC Studios, she says in this parade of change, the law is bringing up the rear.
The laws were written up in the 90s before any of this technology existed, before kids were walking around with powerful computers in their pockets and social networks where if you take a photo and you send it to someone, it can go to lots of different places. And so I think that's what the Canyon City school superintendent is trying to figure out, you know, how much is this about advising the students right this minute? But if a student actually comes forward to a teacher, they're going to take them to the DA's office, even though the DA's office is saying we are going to take each case, look at it individually. They do not want to prosecute kids. But then there's Colorado law, which, as you said, it's child pornography. And what I find so interesting about this too, John, is if you are underage, you can be the victim and the perpetrator simultaneously, which is kind of laughable, while it still can be legal for you to actually have sex. So there's a lot of conflicting messages going out to kids, and I think people are scared because of the legal ramifications, but then they acknowledge that this deserves a very nuanced conversation, and you can't just say, no, don't do this, because, as we know, kids are way better with technology than grown-ups are.
Well, I would stipulate that while you might consider this laughable and interesting, I think there's also this question of how does a school deliver a message on what is appropriate behavior here when one hand is handcuffed to Colorado state law on child pornography and the other hand is probably handcuffed by outraged parents who are looking for some sort of culprit, you know, when in fact, as you describe, this could be a very nuanced sort of social interaction that's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, right? It's almost like this whole thing is playing out on two different levels, the sort of legal and parenting sort of level, but then the sort of, you know, everyone has their own opinions about whether or not teenagers should be having sex, should be having sexual relations. But, you know, I just got a note actually from a pediatrician here in New York, and she said, I see a lot of sexually active kids every week. The reality now is that the human body is extended to the virtual world. Teens exhibiting their bodies to peers is their right. If these are bullies, coercive people, or adults involved in the dissemination of these images, these offenders should be targeted, not the adolescents. I don't think we're there yet as a culture, but it's interesting to hear professionals sort of take on that too.
When adults are involved here, the presence of a child pornographic picture, a naked picture of a minor, is, as far as I can tell, in most states, prima facie evidence for trafficking and predation, and that is a felony. How do you distinguish as an educator between what is innocent trading of images that we've already taught kids they shouldn't be ashamed of, right? In health class?
Right.
I think we did teach them that. How do we decide which is innocent and which is predatory?
Well, and that's why it's so interesting to look at Canyon City, because the DA there, he has said, because he has to say it, right? The Fremont County District Attorney, Tom Ledoux, has said that even some of the kids involved could face charges related to the production, possession, and distribution of sexual exploitive material. But he has said they are not going to do any sort of mass arrests, that they are going to look at each case. And I think that's why there's so much attention on Canyon City, is because not only are the kids doing it there, but there was this sort of, that's the other question, there's this maybe formal ranking system that was created out of all these photos where people were being sort of, it was like baseball cards, which is a little ugh. And so I think in a way Canyon City is going to become potentially an example and a change. Change could come from watching how Canyon City deals with these kids.
And there's no reason to believe that this is just happening in Canyon City. So advice to parents, ask your kids if something like this is going on. Just talk to your kids about what they should do or what?
I mean, I think the question has to also be like, why, not just like, don't do it, because as we know, teenagers don't, I don't have teenagers yet, but I know kids don't listen. I sure didn't when I was a teen. So I think the question is talking more why? What is the need that you feel to send a picture of yourself? Is it because somebody, it feels good that somebody asks you for a picture like this potentially? The question is, let's separate the bullying from the exploration, right? I think that's, as you say, there's a lot of nuance to this. And so understanding, is it a bullying thing? Is it a starting of a relationship thing? Is it wanting to, I mean, a lot of it comes down to gender and the way girls are presented in the society, that they have to be sexy. There's so many issues to unpack here, and just leaving it down to legal or illegal or bad or good is just not going to cut it.
Manoush Zomorodi is the host of WNYC Studios' podcast, Note to Self. Honoré Corder, who's parent of a 15-year-old right here in Austin, Texas, author of the successful Single Mom book series. Just off the top of your head, knowing what's going on in Canyon City, what speech have you prepared for your own teens?
So I had a conversation with my daughter last night about this very situation, this very topic, and she said, I'm aware that it's illegal because my school has educated me. And I said, tell me about that. And she said, it was my entire grade, both last year in ninth grade and this year in 10th grade, everyone in the Performing Arts Center having a conversation about the fact that sexting and pictures and those types of exchanges are not just inappropriate and unacceptable, but illegal. And then as a mom, I'm talking to her about it on a deeper level as to why someone would send those types of pictures, what's going on with them, why they would feel the need to show that, right? And why that might not be appropriate.
The way they view it is totally differently from the way that we viewed
correct.
It when we were their age or even now, right?
That's correct. And we are trying to give our kids the message that they are wonderful and able to share themselves in any way that they feel appropriate, and they should be ashamed of themselves and they should feel proud of themselves and those sorts of things. But I think being proud of yourself, there's a line and it should not be crossed. That's my own personal opinion. And then there's also the issue of the fact that they are making decisions when they share those types of photos and have those types of exchanges, and whether they're having sex, that at some point in their future, they are making a decision today that could affect them in the future, that whatever Google is in 20, 30 years, that particular picture could be found.
So let me hit you with a hypothetical, and this has nothing to do with your daughter, but we do know that you have a daughter. I have daughters as well. Given that this technology is capable of shocking us as well as reassuring us, call up your daughter on 10 o'clock on a Friday night. Oh, you're fine. Great. Love that technology. But what if your daughter had a relationship with another girl, shared a picture of her girlfriend with someone else The police got wind of this, and all of a sudden, the cops wanted to talk to you about your daughter as a trafficker in child pornography. How would you untangle that knot?
I would have a conversation with the police.
All right, so the police need to, like, get out of the picture first.
Obviously, if she's breaking a law, that's
right.
That's a problem. We're going to handle that. And I would have a conversation with the police. I also think that there's intent. And I think it is interesting that laws were written before this type of technology existed and this type of access to each other existed. And I think maybe it's time for a closer look, a sharper look.
And so laws need to get more hip and progressive. People need to have very deep and concrete conversations with their kids. And we got to have a certain amount of, we'll see what happens, right? Because we don't know where this is headed completely.
We don't. And I think there's an element of personal responsibility that should be sprinkled in there for good measure.
So Manoush, have you been listening to these two parents of teenagers talking here?
I have. I've been listening very closely.
Are we terrifying you? Any insights? Anything that might end up on your podcast, a note to self?
Well, yeah. I mean, part of the thing is, like, I've been watching my own sort of evolution. When I first heard about sexting, I don't know, like a couple of years ago, I was totally grossed out by it and terrified. But honestly, the more I talk to kids, I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying I'm starting to understand more of the motivation. And I'm not as maybe prudish about it as I was. Obviously, when the law is involved or adults or bullying, I am absolutely not okay with it. But I think teaching kids the difference there is important. And most importantly, what I want my kids to have is be honest with themselves and to have deep, meaningful friendships. And I think, to me, it's about that care and empathy that we really need to be talking about more and more these days and with technology around. And also the fact that kids need more information and need more time to think these things through for themselves, because they have so many more choices to make than we ever did.
Well, can the three of us all agree that wherever this goes and however different it is from family to family, kid to kid, parent to parent, none of us want any of this to end up in the yearbook, right?
Correct.
All right. On that note of agreement, we will end this discussion. Honoré Corder is parent of a 15-year-old here in Austin, Texas, author of the successful Single Mom book series. Manoush Zomorodi is the host of the WNYC Studios Note to Self podcast. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, John.
You noticed, but this week's GOP debate really clarified a real disagreement over immigration that just might be a hint that even within the Republican Party, longstanding positions might be changing. Donald Trump, you'll recall, invoked Eisenhower's massive deportation programs of the 1950s as justification for his wall on the border idea, while Governor Jeb Bush said times have changed and we can't think of immigration anymore as a reverse D-Day on the banks of the Rio Grande.
12 million illegal immigrants to send them back, 500,000 a month, is just not possible. And it's not embracing American values. And it would tear communities apart. And it would send a signal that we're not the kind of country that I know America is. And even having this conversation sends a powerful signal. They're doing high fives in the Clinton campaign right now when they hear this.
Common ground between Jeb Bush and the Clinton campaign on immigration? Well, an appeals court, the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, ruled this week against President Obama's Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, the DAPA program, a way of postponing or avoiding deportations that would break up families of children born here. And that was a lawsuit filed right here in Texas. On Tuesday, the Obama administration asked the Supreme Court to consider the case in its next term. Joining us is Christina Tinson, who's executive director of the Workers Defense Project, right here at KUT Austin. It's great to talk to you in person.
It's great to be here.
So, first of all, we got two races here. We've got the race in the courts to push back on attempts to liberalize immigration policy by the Obama administration. I want you to explain that. But we've also got a political dynamic within the GOP that may presage some real change here, that maybe there's hope down the line legislatively. Let's talk about the court case first.
What happened this week was a real disappointment for the immigrant community. The Fifth Circuit decided to uphold the injunction against DAPA that would have benefited 5 million families, and now their lives continue to hang in limbo, including my own family. You know, my stepmom is undocumented. I have a 6-year-old sister. And every day when she comes home from school, she has to wonder if she's going to find her mom there or not. And that's something that no child should have to go through. You know, we're hopeful that when this goes to the Supreme Court, that it will be ruled in our favor and we will have justice for 5 million immigrant families that have been waiting for years to see movement on immigration reform.
Now, clearly you're an advocate on DAPA, but with that in mind, who would enforce this? In other words, the Fifth Circuit says DAPA is null and void, but does that mean that border agents or ICE agents suddenly start sweeping neighborhoods? They need the president's order to do that, right?
That's right. But the reality is that immigrant families are constantly living in fear. I can't fully explain the frustration and anguish that that decision has had on our community. I can say that out of great suffering comes great determination, and that my family and the immigrant families I work with are going to mark this 1-year anniversary of when DAPA should have been implemented here in Texas by walking for days from an immigrant detention center here in Texas right to the steps of the governor's mansion where this lawsuit originated from our governor, then acting attorney general, to demand that he meet with the parents and children who he is denying the basic right that so many other people take for granted. And that's when you come home at the end of the day, your family's going to be there.
There have been many protests for various other reasons, from detention centers to legislative state capitals, protesting the consequences of all this limbo. I have a difficult time sorting out the question of Hispanic and Latino lawmakers who describe President Obama in uncharitable terms as the deporter in chief, that he's actually increased the frequency of deportations, yet he's also responsible for DAPA. I would live in fear. I would also live in a sense of confusion. What do you think concretely is going to happen now?
Both political parties in this country understand that they can't take for granted the Latino vote. And when we talk about immigration, we're really also talking about Latinos. We live in a kind of a schizophrenic political time where you can have in the same party someone get up and say, we need to embrace immigrants, and then another candidate get up and call innocent children anchor babies in this country and talk about deporting millions of people.
So what do you think of Jeb Bush saying the other night that it would tear American communities apart to do what Donald Trump is suggesting and some of the other candidates, that it would send a signal that we're not the kind of country that I know America is, and they're doing high fives right now in the Clinton campaign? Do you see changes in traditional Republican intransigence on this, even, dare I say, right here in Texas?
People are playing politics around immigration. The people that propose things like let's deport 11 million people, they're not actually looking for solutions. It's just to get votes. It would take 20 years probably, and we wouldn't even be able to do it. And it would cost billions and billions of dollars. What we're seeing right now is really a fight for how our country's going to look like. And there are some people that want to close the door and think that they can do that as long as possible to not allow Latinos and immigrants to really be part of our country and be part of our democracy. And then there are others that understand that they can't take this community for granted and they can't stop what's going to happen, and that this country is changing and that they need to embrace that. And so that's the fight you're seeing in the Republican Party and across also the Democratic Party that for years also towed some of the similar line that you see Republicans towing.
But you remind us that as this conversation goes on, your family lives in fear, that it may be arguments over votes, but it's fear around your dinner table.
It's fear and children that are growing up in this country. You know, I was preparing a group of children last night that we're going to talk about during this pilgrimage that we're doing where they're walking for days. And I said, you know, imagine what you would want to tell the presidents, people that are running for president, how this is impacting your family. And I had a 12-year-old girl crying, saying that every day she hears on TV that her family is not worth as much, that she doesn't matter, that she's not wanted. And that is the kind of message that we're sending to children in this country.
Christina Zinsun is Executive Director of the Workers' Defense Project. Christina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will meet once again this weekend in Vienna. Diplomacy pushing or being pushed by events in Syria. Russia has called for the creation of a new constitution in Syria within 18 months, but it doesn't mention any sort of relinquishing of power by dictator Bashar al-Assad. Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC, says Russia's military moves have changed the diplomatic game and pushed a lot of pieces around on the board in the Middle East.
The Russian military intervention in Syria, its airstrikes, has changed not just the situation on the ground, but also what it has, of course, done is it has radically changed the whole diplomatic context as well, making it absolutely clear that if there is to be any kind of settlement, the diplomatic road runs as much through Moscow as anywhere else.
Do you think the downing of the plane in Sinai, even though it's wrapped in smoke and mirrors at this point, is also driving Russian enthusiasm about all this?
I think it does underscore the fact that President Putin, for all his bravado and expansive presentation of Russia's foreign policy, realizes that this intervention in Syria is only going to be successful in Russian terms if it is limited both in duration and scope. If it expands too far, then Russia risks entanglement or worse. So I think it's no surprise now that we're seeing the other boot dropping, as it were, that the Russians clearly have in mind both a military strategy on the one hand with a pretty clear limited aims, but very much an accompanying diplomatic strategy that goes along with it.
Does Russia lose face if Bashar al-Assad goes, in the sense that the Russians have been supportive of his regime, and the United States has declared almost as a precondition that he go?
Well, let's be clear. A lot of Western leaders, including the Americans, have backed away from the idea that President Assad needs to go immediately. And of course, the Russians probably are not wedded to the man himself in the long term. They're wedded to a regime in Syria that furthers Russia's interests. The Russian proposals, I'd hesitate to call it a peace plan yet, but they envisage a sort of 18-month period during which there would be a new constitution drafted, there would be a referendum on that constitution, and if it were approved, there would be new presidential and new parliamentary elections. Interestingly, they say that the president that emerged from that election would still be in charge of foreign policy and the armed forces, but that the parliament, presumably a prime minister, would be in charge, would have executive power over domestic matters.
So what do you make of this offensive in Sinjar near the Syrian Iraqi border, Islamic State militants being attacked by Kurds with the U.S. support? Is that an attempt to grab territory on the ground while this diplomatic initiative is going on? Or is it the U.S. fighting the battle for an independent Kurdistan, something that most Americans on the streets of New York and Chicago would be surprised to learn we're involved in?
Well, of course, the Americans, I don't think, would like to present it as that, not least because it poses particular problems with Turkey, whose probably biggest concern in all of this crisis is what it might do in terms of leading to potentially a Kurdish state of some kind. I think what we're seeing across the board in both Syria and Iraq are efforts, albeit with limited American air power, to try and roll back Islamic State where that can be done. Being able to rely, the vital thing is to be able to rely upon effective forces on the ground, and the Kurdish forces have proved throughout this contest to be amongst the most able on which the Americans can rely. The Syrian government forces have made some gains in and around Aleppo, although the fighting there is still very fraught, but they've pushed through to a besieged air base and appear to have been able to relieve the siege on that air base. So you see a patchwork picture of a certain amount of pressure on Islamic State, but of course none of this really represents a full-scale military campaign.
Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC, speaking to us from London. Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Russian, retirement planning, and rock climbing. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
We learned this year that democracy is for rookies. You know, maybe it's better the first time.
I'm running for office for the first time.
For the first time.
For the first time.
For the first time.
Because I believe that judges should be fair, impartial.
Personal experience, educational expertise, and the heart.
We need a fresh new voice in local government.
Crime and criminal justice reform.
We can debate, disagree, listen, learn, and compromise.
Those challenges also bring opportunity and risk.
We really need that diversity of thought.
Every single American deserves a shot at chasing their dreams.
We followed candidates running for office for the very first time all around the country. And our slate here on The Takeaway did pretty well.
November 3rd was a beautiful, sunshine-filled day for democracy here in Falls Church. I came in second with about 100 votes behind the current mayor who was up for re-election, which means I was elected to city council.
I'm happy to say I'm a newly elected member of the Jeffco School Board.
Unfortunately, I lost my election for Commonwealth Court in Pennsylvania.
And in my election, we won with 78% of the vote.
To be honest, it hasn't quite sunk in yet. It turned out to be a very contentious and divisive election.
I lost by 53% to 47% of the vote.
Now I get down to work. It's time for me to listen and learn.
My term begins on January 1st, so between now and then, I plan to continue sitting in on as many meetings as possible so I really hit the ground running come January.
What's next for me is starting my term.
So for me, I just go back to practicing law and doing what I love.
I hope I remain a student of our community and our kids' needs during the next 4 years.
Public service is both an honor and a privilege, and I look forward to representing Falls Church in the next 4 years.
And hopefully maybe try again in 2 years.
We're proud of you, Mom!
You can hear there Paul Lally lost his Illinois judge race, while Amanda Stevens won a seat on the Jefferson County School Board in Colorado. Letty Hardy won her race in Falls Church, Virginia, and Lorena Gonzalez in Seattle made history. She became the first Latina elected on Seattle's city council. Candidate Eric Caulfield looked great on paper, PhD from MIT, Phi Beta Kappa from Morehouse, a White House fellow, tireless campaigner for Louisiana State Senate District 4. He lost, though, got only 25% of the vote. But each vote, he says, taught him something. And his challenger's success turned out to be a test of Eric's beliefs and his stamina. And Eric says he's ready for more.
I think one of the most important things about this experience is you really just have to follow what's in your heart. For something as intense and as long and enduring as a campaign, you really got to just be very clear about what you're doing and why you're doing it, just because it's a very, very involved process. And you just really got to believe in it. You got to love it.
The numbers are, you know, 75% went to candidates other than you, and you got 25% of the vote, which must make you feel good. But do you feel in your gut that like 3/4 of the people who are your neighbors don't like you in some way?
No, I think the overwhelming sense was that in the end, there were lots of political kinds of relationships and personal relationships that pre-existed before the race. And I kind of knew that coming in. And the idea was that by being able to tell a good story, that we might be able to convince some of those folks to come our way. Almost everybody that I've talked to, and the response has been overwhelming in some sense, was that we ran a really, really good race and that we got our message out. We did it in a way which was positive. And already folks have been talking to me about what the next thing is going to be and really encouraging me to run for something else. And these are even people who may not have been necessarily with us this time, but people are very interested in what's coming next for me. So the only thing that we really lost and are not in a stronger position in was the race itself.
Who else is encouraging you? What about family, friends?
Oh, everybody has been just super supportive. Of course, you know, my mom, I think, was probably the most disappointed in terms of the outcome. But, you know, she raised me to fight for the things that I care about and to never give up. This is really just the first step in a much longer process for whatever I decide to run for next. And there will be a next race. When and what remains to be seen. But, you know, this definitely isn't the end of my engagement in public service.
No. People are going to remember your name, Eric Caulfield. Now, you had to convince your mother, though, that the people who voted against you, they aren't enemies. They're just fellow citizens, right?
Yes. My mom has scrap. And so, you know, when I was making the decision to run and just kind of weighing what it was going to be like, you kind of have to steel yourself for it because it's a pugilistic endeavor. And elections certainly can be very combative. It was interesting to me and reassuring in a lot of ways that a lot of my family and friends just took a lot of the things that the opposition was saying, they took it a lot harder than I did. And it was like, oh, I can't believe he said that. You have to respond. And I was like, well, you know, tactically, maybe we want to come back a different way, which says quite a bit about the people that are with you and how excited people were about the campaign and wanting to be supportive.
And also the toll that it takes on the people who love you. You know, that's something you have to calculate in when you decide to do this again.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we spoke a long time ago and you were considering taking this plunge, you really described this as once you go over that line, you've entered a whole different world and a whole different set of experiences.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel that way?
Absolutely. And I remember, you know, you asked one question about if this was the hardest thing that I'd ever done. And at the time, you know, I think I said, no, it wasn't. But what I can say definitively is this is the hardest thing that I've ever done in my life. You learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about the people around you. You learn a lot about the community, quite frankly. In some sense, there is nothing that's quite like a campaign. Just the pace of it, both physical, mental, emotional, is unlike anything you've ever done until you've actually done this thing. You know, in theory, you can shadow box it out in your mind and you have an idea of what it is. And even if you've worked on campaigns, I'm told by folks who've done a lot of campaigns, until you're the candidate, it's a very different experience. And so I'm really grateful in some sense to have had a chance to go through it. And even just watching political debates on television, you experience that even in a different way, just because you've been through it. You've been on the stage. You've been in the debates. You've been in the forums. You've had to answer the questions. It really gives you a chance to look at the world through a different lens. And so, you know, it's been a really positive experience in that way.
Eric Caulfield, he sounds like a winner, but he actually lost the Louisiana State Senate District 4 race with 25% of the vote. But as you can hear, anxious for another challenge. Eric Caulfield, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John. It's good to talk to you as always.
Call me old-fashioned, but I think of archaeology as a romp through deserts and jungles, to ancient ruins and meticulously dug caves and excavations, to see ancient history with maybe a little romance thrown in.
How dare you kiss me?
Now, you couldn't do anything that fun or useful in ancient ruins from space, could you? Hundreds of miles above the Earth?
The sunrise. Terrific.
Well, there actually is something called satellite archaeology, and the 2016 TED Prize this year went to SatArc scientist Sarah Parkak at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. The prize comes with $1 million and recognizes her work using satellite imagery to monitor archaeological sites in ancient Egypt. Parkak is founding director of the University of Alabama's Birmingham Laboratory for Global Observation, using high-resolution images from space to track things that are hard to see from the ground. Her first successes have been hunting criminals, looters, not treasure, yet.
Just after the Arab Spring started in Egypt in late January in 2011, we started hearing rumors about looters going after archaeological sites near Cairo. And it's one thing to hear rumors or eyewitness reports. It's another thing entirely to be able to capture that data from space. Images don't lie. We've got a lot of before data for many sites in Egypt. And what we do is look at the after data, and we look for small dark circles or squares surrounded by a donut shape of earth, which indicates recent digging. And they look very, very different from excavation units. So it's really this comparative before and after imagery analysis that shows us exactly where looters have been digging pits.
Now, are you taking pictures of the barn with the doors open and the horse is gone? I mean, how do you act on that data?
So we don't know what the looters have taken, just because it's like any excavation. You don't know what you're going to find until you dig. But what we do know is that there are a lot of intact tombs in Egypt, or partially intact tombs. Let's face it, looting has been going on for thousands and thousands of years in Egypt, really since ancient Egypt. And we know that the looters are targeting specific sites that have tombs with a lot of objects in them. What really concerns me is oftentimes you see looters come in, they go after a looting pit, and after a while the sand blows in. So obviously that hole is covered up. But a lot of pits remain open. And in Egypt, you know, this is a civilization that lasted for thousands of years and as a result has just millions of tombs. And oftentimes these tombs would be built one on top of the other. So when looters come in and keep a hole open, and we see that hole remain open, it worries me because I wonder, they've tunneled down, and are they going deeper and deeper and going after other tombs? That's something I can't see from space.
Can you dispatch Egyptian authorities to the site in time to get enough forensic evidence to apprehend criminals?
So I collaborate very closely with Egypt's Ministry of Antiquities, and they have this incredible department led by my friend Ali Ahmed. It's Egypt's Recovery and Repatriation Unit. And what we're doing is we're sharing all of our satellite data with them, showing them exactly where in Egypt is being targeted by the looters, because they've got a really robust database of thousands of objects that they've recovered from people attempting to smuggle them out of Egypt. And we're trying to match up the data, trying to figure out where these pieces are coming from. And in some instances, we're making them aware of looting going on at sites where they simply had no idea. Ultimately, the plan, you know, long term, is can we use small satellites or new satellite data to capture looting going on in almost real time so that we can actually do something about it and get the people that are doing the looting.
Why do you think the TED folks gave you this prize? What is it about your work that they're honoring?
I think in this particular case, the timing is really important. You know, clearly for the past 2 years, and especially this year and this summer, we've seen massive destruction of archaeological sites and looting by ISIL in Syria and Iraq. These, you know, incredibly iconic sites like Palmyra have been ransacked, or they've had, you know, these beautiful features on them blown up by ISIL. And I think with climate change, with urbanization, you know, there's so many threats to archaeological sites around the world. And we're really at a tipping point with protecting our shared global heritage. You know, we've got all the tools and all the technologies and all the knowledge to protect the sites. And if we don't do something about it, so many of these sites are just simply going to be gone.
Do you have plans for that $1 million that the TED Prize gives you?
So I will make my wish to the world on Tuesday, February 16th in the evening. And the talk will be streamed live for the world to see. So I encourage folks to go to TED.com and go to TED Prize, where they can sign up to get information about my wish and be notified when I'm going to be speaking. And I would encourage everyone to listen.
It's kind of an exciting time to contemplate things like TED wishes, I would think.
I am so thrilled and honored to be able to do this. And when I heard that I'd won, I just felt this very heavy weight on my shoulders. You know, archaeology is a field where we're literally still citing papers and articles that came out 100 or almost 200 years ago. That's still relevant today. So to us, everyone who's come before us is still very much alive. And I definitely carry that with me. You know, I feel like this award is about my field. And you know, everyone loves archaeology. Everyone wants to be an archaeologist when they're little. And I think we need to tap into that excitement of discovery, because these kids are all brilliant. They're all tech savvy. They've got huge hearts. We archaeologists will be able to hopefully use that to be able to save these sites for these kids, because that they deserve it.
Finally, are you worried that the good that you're doing would lead to more acceptance of government surveillance using satellite data and corporate surveillance of people using satellite data?
So this is actually a big debate that's going on right now, both in the archaeological world and clearly more broadly. And I think that runs both ways. People want their privacy, of course. But on the flip side, we can use this data to monitor people doing a whole range of illegal activities, whether it's looting, whether it's illegal fishing, whether it's illegal land development. So there's some give and take that we have to think about. And you know, certainly in my world, the looters are already using satellite data to find sites. So we've got to try to stay one step ahead of the looters. And I think these are all going to be pretty serious issues that we have to consider.
Sarah Parkak, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Parkak is a satellite archaeologist and founding director of the University of Alabama at Birmingham's Laboratory for Global Observation. you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.